Leaders of resistance groups calling for unity among Muslims to support Palestinians in the face of the Israeli aggression. The UN chief calls for a ceasefire in Ukraine during a visit to Russia, while the Russian foreign ministry says Moscow supports diplomatic means to end the conflict. And Russia expels four Swedish diplomats a day after it declared 40 German diplomatic staff in Russia persona non grata. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank, and that's while the regime's atrocities taking place on a daily basis. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 20-year-old Ahmed Ibrahim Waidat succumbed to his injuries after being shot in the head. The violence happened at a refugee camp near Ariha early this morning. Since March, Israel has intensified crackdown across the occupied territories. Palestinians have also been conducting retaliatory attacks against Israelis. Tensions also have been high in Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Tel Aviv has increased attacks on Palestinian worshippers during the holy months of Ramadan. The daily aggression has drawn strong condemnation from Muslim countries. Now, several prominent religious figures and leaders of resistance movements have addressed people across the world in a virtual conference commemorating International Quds Day. Ziad al-Nakhala, leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, opened the conference, saying that resistance is currently at its height. He stressed that Palestine belongs to Palestinians, no matter how many tyrants join hands with Israel. Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh said that Palestinians will deter all projects of division and Judaization. He said that Israel has taken advantage of normalization to go ahead with its plans against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, said that defending Al-Quds is the responsibility of the entire Islamic world. Then we had Bahrain's top Shiite cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, who said that Palestinians are suffering from the most atrocious attacks by the Tel Aviv regime. Also, Yemen's Ansar leader addressed the conference. Now from Ramallah, let's bring in Saad Nimr. He's a professor of political science with Barzaj University. Good to have you with us, Professor. So, we are approaching the International Quds Day. Tell us about the significance of that day. And also, you heard about the comments made by these leaders of resistance front. Let's have your take on their comments and your assessment of the escalating situation these days in the occupied territories.
In reality, we are waiting for this year's Quds Day, because this year we believe that it's going to be a significant day for Jerusalem, especially after all the atrocities that have been done from the very beginning of Ramadan this year against the Al-Aqsa Mosque, against the Jerusalem, against the Palestinians and worshippers who are attending or try to attend Al-Aqsa Mosque, and what happened since the beginning of Ramadan this year, and how many of the martyrs that we have this year. So this year, I think that Al-Quds Day will have such a significant importance regarding what's going on in the situation back in Palestine. Also, we have witnessed around the world so many demonstrations in support of Al-Quds and in support of the Palestinians, whether it was in Germany, in Britain, and even in America. In so many countries, the people do realize and know the atrocities by the Israelis, and that Israel is as a colonial state and as a racist apartheid state is really, you know, they are condemning this kind of a state, and they are asking for a boycott of Israel around the world. The other thing is about this year was that the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, whether it is the Islamic Jihad or Hamas or the other Palestinian factions, are more ready than any time else. And the Israeli apparently do know that, and that's why they were willing to listen to the resistance after all, especially during the last 10 days of Ramadan, to stop all the incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque and to stop this kind of demonstration, flag demonstration, which is supposed to be to go inside Old Jerusalem, the Old City, and they stopped it because they knew that the resistance are ready. At the same time, we believe that the resistance in South Lebanon is also in a full readiness for any event. And in the speech of Samahat Hassan Nasrallah, he said so, that we are ready this year and never been as much ready as we are today. And we believe that our final battle will be with Israel, that to end this kind of state, and that all the Palestinians, the Lebanese, and even the our also people in Yemen, the Houthis, are also they expressed their concern and their also readiness. So what we are talking about, that this time of year we are talking about the best for the Palestinians, and I think that, and for the region in general, that all powers are ready and all powers are united, and they are having, let me say, one target, you know, to prevent any Israeli aggression against the Palestinian or against Al-Quds. And Al-Quds is a red line, as many of the resistance movement have declared, that it is a red line, and we would never allow Israel to cross this red line. So we think that after all these years of atrocities and all of these years of occupation and the Israeli aggression against the Palestinians and the region in general, I think we have reached this moment that now there is a real threat to Israel, and the Israeli do know that this time of this year, it's totally different from other years, and it is not just as a trap that they could go into any war, whether it's in Gaza or in South Lebanon. And this time it is different totally, and people are ready, you know, to give them a lesson that they would never ever even forget, or even if they still do exist anymore.
Okay, thank you so much. Saad Nim, Professor of Political Science with Berzaich University in Ramallah. Not Russia's military offensive in Ukraine has taken a new casualty, Moscow's ties with Tel Aviv. Israel, which had volunteered for mediating between Ukraine and Russia when the war started, appears to be taking sides now. Moscow is warning Tel Aviv of the consequences of such partiality.
The Israeli-Russian ties have been deteriorating rapidly over the past few weeks. Most recently, Russia's ambassador to Israel, Anatoly Viktorov, has warned that Moscow will introduce retaliatory measures against Israel in case the Tel Aviv regime supplies Ukraine with military equipment and aid amid the military conflict there. Viktorov issued the warning in a televised interview on Thursday. It was not immediately clear from the Russian envoy's remarks what such a response might entail.
And I think that we'll see strengthening of cooperation and increased military support for Syria and other regional partners of Russia in the region if Israel goes along with supporting Ukraine. And it's important to note that Ukraine has said that it wants to be in Israel. It wants to be Israel in Europe. It doesn't want to be absolutely liberal and European.
The comments came a day after the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Israel will provide Ukraine with helmets and flak jackets. Last week, the Russian Foreign Ministry summoned Israeli ambassador to Moscow after Tel Aviv denounced Russia's military operation in Ukraine. It came after the Israeli Foreign Minister accused Russia of committing war crimes in Ukraine, alleging that there was no justification for Russia's military campaign against its Western neighbor. Earlier this month, the Israeli regime voted in favor of a United Nations General Assembly resolution suspending the Russian Federation's membership in the UN Human Rights Council. The move was made over claims of gross and systematic violations and abuses of human rights in Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry called the resolution, quote, unlawful and politically motivated.
Russia says that Israel has taken advantage of the situation surrounding Ukraine to divert public attention from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, one of the world's oldest unresolved disputes. And that has become especially clear due to the heavy-handed tactics that Israel has recently used against Palestinians while desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque. Many observers believe it indeed is ironic to hear the accusation of war crimes from Israeli officials who are widely blamed for crimes against the people of Palestine.
Taking a sideswipe at Israel and the United States, the Russian Foreign Ministry has said that the longest occupation in the post-war history is being carried out by Israel with the tacit approval of the West. The ministry further bashed the blockade of the besieged Gaza Strip, which Israel says is needed to prevent arms from reaching the Palestinian resistance movements in the enclave.
Well, one of the things that it's important is that Israel saying that Russia has committed war crimes is laughable, since Israel itself has been liable and the charges are severe to their war crimes and human rights violations against the Palestinian people, most recently in the war on the people of Gaza just last year in 2021.
Ukraine has asked Israel for weapons and equipment, including the Iron Dome missile system, something that Tel Aviv hasn't publicly approved so far. Russia has said that foreign weapons sent to Ukraine will be fair game for its military attacks. If Israel decides to sell arms to Russia's western neighbor, will there be a conflict between the two?
So I think it's not yet sure what's happening, but I think what we are seeing is a shift of Israel from being neutral in this current special military operation to openly supporting Ukraine. So it might shift, but it will cost them. It'll cost them heavily because Russia is an important player in Israel-Palestine.
Since Russian President Vladimir Putin announced a special military operation in Ukraine on February 24 and officially recognized the breakaway regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as two republics, the political lines across the globe have been getting redrawn. As Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned, that risks the situation spiraling into a third world war.
I'm moving on. The UN chief calling for a ceasefire in Ukraine during a joint press conference with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow.
But it is my deep conviction that the sooner we end this war, the better for the people of Ukraine, for the people of the Russian Federation, and those far beyond. The United Nations has repeatedly called for ceasefires to protect civilians and to facilitate a political dialogue to reach a solution. So far, that has not been possible.
Now, Guterres says that there is a crisis within a crisis in the besieged Ukrainian city of Mariupol. He called for the evacuation of civilians trapped there and demanded the establishment of a humanitarian contact group. Lavrov said that Moscow is ready to cooperate with the UN to help civilians in Ukraine. He said that Russia's goals are primarily to protect the civilian population. He added that Moscow supports a peaceful resolution to the crisis at the negotiation table. Now, Lavrov said the aim of Russian operation in Ukraine was to counter NATO's expansion and protect the Russian-speaking population. He says that NATO has been using Ukraine to irritate and contain Russia. He also accused Ukraine of violating the Minsk peace agreement. The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, insists that providing deadly weapons to Ukraine is the right thing to do. However, there's growing opposition to the West policy in this regard over concerns it will prolong the ongoing conflict with Russia. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The EU and its Western allies continue to pour hundreds of millions of euro worth of deadly weapons into Ukraine. Speaking in India on Monday, the head of the bloc's executive arm, Ursula von der Leyen, defended this policy.
Our response to Russia's aggression today will decide the future of both the international system and the global economy.
Just last week in the European Parliament, a number of legislators questioned the wisdom of pumping lethal weapons into Ukraine.
If there is a ceasefire, who's going to disarm those individuals who are receiving these arms? We know how weapons sent to fight al-Assad in Syria ended up being used for attacks in other countries.
Also, it's clear many EU citizens are against the enormous militarization of Ukraine by the West.
If you send weapons, maybe you will encourage the conflict.
We all must hope the world need peace.
I think the peace is the best way.
Weapon is not the answer to nothing.
Poverty is on the rise in the EU, and so campaigners say the huge amounts of money being spent on providing weapons for the conflict could be better spent.
People are faced with the COVID crisis, you know, with energy crisis, you know, the bills of people are tripled or even quadrupled. So it's something ununderstandable.
But the European Commission insists the arming of Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict.
The war can stop today if Russia decides that it should stop. It has nothing to do with the arms deliveries to Ukraine. Ukraine is only defending itself.
However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Otherwise, they suggest, there is no way of ending this conflict. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia expels 4 Swedish diplomats in response to the expulsion of 3 of its diplomatic staff by Stockholm earlier this month. Russian foreign minister says it summoned the Swedish ambassador and strongly protested the expulsion of Russian diplomats. The minister says it also lodged a complaint about Sweden's military support for Kyiv. It accused the Nordic nation of covering up the crimes of those whom it calls Ukrainian nationalists against the civilian population in the Donbass region. The tit-for-tat diplomatic move comes amid rising tensions between Moscow and the West over the war in Ukraine. The U.S., the EU, and their allies have expelled hundreds of Russian diplomats, with Moscow responding in kind. On Monday, Moscow declared 40 German diplomatic staff persona non grata in response to an earlier move by Berlin.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that Imam Khomeini authored the book Kashf al-Asrar in response to the misleading book 1000 Year Secrets, which had been written by Ali Akbar Hakamizadeh, an erstwhile student of seminary who left for the US while no more wearing the costume of clergymen. It was said that Imam Khomeini's book can be considered as the starting point of his struggles against the Pahlavi regime and his endeavor to establish the Islamic rule. Today, we are going to dwell upon that part of the Imam's struggles which were against the Shah's so-called white revolution. As usual, the narrator is mainly Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi. After the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Borujerdi in 1961, Iran's Shah, Mohammad Reza, thought that one of the main obstacles against his anti-religious moves and consolidation of his tyrannical rule had gone. Therefore, he started fighting off Islam and ulema very seriously and openly. However, his dream was very soon shattered by Imam Khomeini's uprising, which fell upon him like a nightmare. The Imam raised the banner of a struggle against the regime and its main supporter, the U.S., opening a new chapter in the political and religious atmosphere of the country. Imam Khomeini's wife narrates, "The Imam was a wise, clever, and religious man. After the demise of Ayatollah Borujerdi, he staged uprising against the Shah apparatus, which wanted to set aside religion and march in the path of the West. As he was a very religious and devoted person, whenever the religion and religiosity were mocked at, it was as if his children had been beheaded in front of him. After the late Borujerdi, the Shah intended to set aside clergymen and religion in Iran forever. Of course, he had made the decision at the time of late Borujerdi, but his power wouldn't let the Shah do such a thing. In those days, the man of politics and the field of a struggle against the regime was Ayatollah Kashani, and Mr. Khomeini was acquainted with him, but there was not a political relation in the modern sense, and, as I have said, the Imam's main job was studying and discussion." Imam Khomeini had a positive opinion on the struggles of Ayatollah Kashani, although he had some critical views too. The Imam's wife continues, "My father said that when Mr. Kashani had seen Mr. Ruhullah for the first time, he told my father, 'Where have you found this prodigy? He's a good base for the future.' Mr. Khomeini liked Mr. Kashani's struggles generally and would go to his house too. But it was not that much to say that he had a role in late Kashani's political establishment. After late Borujerdi, the Imam, besides studying and discussion, had become a source of emulation himself and considered himself responsible before events. Thus, he couldn't be silent against deviations and believed that silence against oppression is a bigger oppression. In the winter of 1963, the American President John F. Kennedy advised the Shah to implement the so-called reforms, calling it the White Revolution, or the Revolution of the Shah and the People. This measure comprised issues which were seemingly useful, such as land reforms, granting the right to vote to women, and giving shares of the profits of factories to workers. But the Shah's main aim was to bolster the foundation of his despotic rule and destroying strong social forces such as the clergymen and landowners. Ms. Saghafi says, "In 1963, the government decided to do some reforms. Although it was not that important, it implied issues which would make them important. The Imam believed that the Shah had taken the first step cautiously, but his next steps would be serious danger for Islam and the country's independence. Therefore, he couldn't be silent against the Shah and Thai religious moves. Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Saghafi, referring to her protest to the Imam as why he was the only one among the ulema and sources of emulation to oppose the Shah's plan, says, "The Imam felt his duty in this regard and considered himself accountable before God. I told him, why do other ulema and sources of emulation not protest and it is only you who feel the duty?" He answered, "I don't bother them, lady. By God, I am responsible. If you are ready to see God punishing me on the judgment day, tell me to keep silent." So I was sure that the Imam had a mission which he had to fulfill. Therefore, I always try to pave the ground for his activity. Imam Khomeini's courageous and explicit opposition to the Shah's so-called referendum infuriated the latter, and there were rumors of arresting the Imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini was so calm and unmoved. Ms. Saghafi narrates as follows. "The morning gatherings and narrations of Imam Hussein's tragedy were different from those of the previous years. Little by little, these narrations were finding their true meaning, which was the memory of martyrs and combatants of the path of freedom and religion. They had gradually changed from amusement and stupor to movement and awareness. Preachers had turned the issue from the state of stupor and would prepare the people for resistance against all tortures and torments. Preparation for uprising. The uprising like Hussein by his descendant Khomeini. When the rumor prevailed on Imam Khomeini's arrest, one night he told me, 'If they arrest me, do not be anxious.' I told him jokingly, 'That's good, as I will breathe for a while.' In the advent of his struggles, the Imam would tell Ahmad, 'Tonight they may arrest me. Don't fear. If they come and arrest me, don't do anything. Don't seek help from anyone to relieve me. Even do not accept anyone's money for livelihood.'"
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I want to speak about three of the benefits of fasting at this point as we try and really benefit from this month. So one of the things that we can benefit from this month is that it is a month of spirituality. It is a complete body experience, actually. Not just hunger and thirst, but the fasting is to fast our entire body. Our sight, our hearing, our speech, where we go, what we do, who we associate with, what we're saying, what we're typing, what we're reading, what we're listening to, everything. And this is clear from the hadith, and I'm just going to give you one hadith on each of these three topics today. The hadith on the spirituality of fasting comes to us from our beloved Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, in which he has been quoted as saying that whenever you fast, so let your hearing, your vision, and your skin fast. And then the companion who was narrating this hadith, he says the Prophet went on to mention a number of other body parts that should be engaged in the fasting as well. And then the Prophet said the day of your fast should not happen to be like the day of your breaking, meaning the day that you're not fasting. So fasting is also to not look at the impermissible, to not listen to the impermissible, to not speak the impermissible, to not do anything with any part of the body, not just, you know, preventing the stomach or the throat or the lips or the mouth. It is to prevent every organ of the body from what it wants, what it may desire, what it may lust after even. That's the first aspect of fasting that we need to recognize to be able to benefit from this month to the fullest potential possible, is to recognize the spirituality of it. The second aspect of Ramadan is the social effect. You know, it brings some balance in society. And I say some, you know, underline, bold, capitalize that word. There's only some balance which is brought in society, you know, again, because it's only for 30 days. But the hope is that whatever you and I will learn in 30 days will then, God willing, continue through the rest of the year. And this is actually in the hadith, the sayings of the Prophet and his family, may Allah bless all of them, where they've shown us that fasting, as much as it is a spiritual experience to connect to Allah, to connect to God, it's also a social work in progress. And so we have a hadith from the 11th Imam, Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam, in which he was once asked the rationale, the reasoning, the philosophy behind the obligation of fasting. And he replied to the individual saying that so that the rich may experience the pain of hunger and bestow their generosity upon the poor. You know, when you are blessed by God to have everything at your disposal, you don't feel hunger ever from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed. And maybe you work or live in an area where you don't even have an opportunity to see a homeless, to interact with a destitute, a poor person. Maybe your entire network of family and friends are people in a similar income bracket. So you don't, you know, go to homes of people who maybe live in an apartment, a one bedroom with four people or more, as some of our community members have gone through and continue to go through. You don't feel hunger, you don't feel any of the difficulties. You want something, you need a new computer or a phone or a TV, you just go online and a few clicks, you order it, and it's at your doorstep the next day. And so the 11th Imam says that one of the philosophies behind the fast of Ramadan is so that the rich may experience the pain of hunger. Not only experience the pain, but to follow up and help the poor. And so we see that there is a spiritual component, a social component rather. As with a lot of actions in Islam, prayers have a personal component and a societal component. Hajj, obviously, the greatest show of social importance in Islam. Many other acts of worship are of a social nature. The charity that we give is to help bring up the people in society who are the deprived, who are the less, you know, who are the most vulnerable of the society. So that's the second reason, is the social impact. The third, though, and I want to, you know, mention this and then we will conclude in the next few minutes, are the health effects. We don't deny that we live in a gluttonous society today. I don't want to only point the finger at us, but you go around the world to many other countries. Yes, there are some countries which are very deprived and very don't have it as good as we do. But there are many countries, not only in North America and Europe, but even in the Middle East, for example, and even in the Far East, where it is a very gluttonous society. It's a very carefree society where you eat what you want. You can order what you want. We have whole movies and documentaries called Super Size Me, to show the level of availability of food and excessive food at that as well. High caloric food, very low nutritional value food. The fact today that you can sit at home and on your phone, you can order a meal from hundreds of different restaurants. and have it delivered to you shows the challenges that even the health experts are pointing to of the society and the changes and the mindset that people have gotten into. And so, as I said, that although Ramadan and the fasting is a spiritual experience to connect to God, it is also a social experience in connecting to humanity by feeling the pain of others and hopefully being generous to help the needy out. It is also a benefit for the health. And so we have a hadith from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, where he has been quoted as saying that the stomach is the home of every disease, and fasting/dieting is the peak of every medicine. You know, it's not necessarily a need, unless obviously you got to that extreme of having to take medication for health complications, people spending millions of dollars on diets, on fads every month. Maybe a new diet is coming out, this diet, that diet. People name diets after various foods and various food groups and various individuals. And you see TV commercials promising weight loss by downloading an app and going through the process, or signing up and eating certain special foods you have to purchase from companies for thousands of dollars a year. And maybe some people may need all of that, perhaps. But if you go right back down to the basics, is as the Prophet says, the stomach is the home of every disease. Because we are putting too much food into our stomach, we're putting the wrong things into our stomach, given the fact that we also live in a society with processed food, the fact that a lot of our food are contaminated by chemicals, all of this is perhaps adding to the situation. You know, we don't live the life of 14 centuries ago. We don't even live the life of 100 years ago, where there were few and far between in terms of fast food, even if there was even a concept or a word called fast food 100 years ago. I don't think there was. Right? But we live in a time now where fast food is available. Food, again, as I said, high caloric intake, low nutritional value, high in sodium, high in cholesterol, high in fats, and low in actual benefit to the human body. So the Prophet says that the stomach is the storehouse, the central point of every disease that you can think of. And fasting/dieting is the way to give yourself a home personal remedy and cure. Now, I'm not saying you don't go to the doctor, or you don't take your medication, or you don't go to the gym. Those are all needed if you need to go to that route. But my point is that if we begin to teach our children from a young age, and maybe the schools aren't teaching it, so we need to maybe teach this on the minbar, in the majalis, in the madrasa, about healthy eating, about actively knowing what we eat, where it comes from, and the nutritional value. If we can learn these from a young age, then we will perhaps be able to ensure our next generation are more health conscious than we are, that they eat better than we do.
Dear listeners of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, you can follow this program entitled Minbar every day in the month of Ramadan. If you have any suggestion, you can send us your email at englishradio@irib.ir.
Love is everywhere, so much peace fills up the air. Ramadan, month of the Quran, I feel it inside me, strengthening my iman. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, in no month, the faithful have been recommended to pray and supplicate as in the blessed month of Ramadan. Interestingly, in many of the prayers of this month, a special attention has been paid to the Imam of the Age, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. The aspirations and ideals of mankind are highly bolded in these prayers and supplications. These ideals will materialize only in the time of Imam Mahdi's rule, and he's the person who will lead humanity towards that ideal society. According to the Islamic narrations, Ramadan is the best month for praying, and the best prayer is to ask God to expedite the reappearance of the Savior of mankind. One of the famous supplications and prayers that the faithful are recommended to recite in the nights of Ramadan is Dua-e-Iftitah, or prayer of opening. Opening here means removal of sorrows and end of miseries and solving all problems. The prayer begins with praising God and celebrating His attributes, glorifying His mercy and seeking His forgiveness. Then God is praised and thanked for guiding us through the Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors. The Prophet of Islam, his daughter Fatima, and the 12 Imams are mentioned and greeted in the prayer by name. And the prayer ends with complaining God for the absence of Imam Mahdi and beseeching God to terminate the period of occultation and hasten the Imam's reappearance. In part of the prayer we say, O God, indeed we are inclined toward you in the noble government of Imam Mahdi, whereby you will dignify Islam and its people, and will abase hypocrisy and its people, and will make us among the callers to your obedience and leaders to your way, and through it grant us the nobility of the world and the hereafter. We hope that God will answer the prayers of the faithful across the world and will shorten the period of Imam Mahdi's stay in occultation, as he is the last savior of mankind. He is the man who will obliterate injustice and tyranny and will spread justice everywhere. One of the beautiful traditions in Islam is relation with relatives. Relations with relatives is called Sile-i Rahim. It means visiting each other and helping one another in problems. This tradition is very effective in the life of this world and the hereafter. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says in his famous sermon on the blessed month of Ramadan, "In this month, have relation with relatives. He who keeps relation with relatives, God will send his mercy to him of the day of judgment. While he who severs relation with relatives, God will keep his mercy away from him." According to the narrations, relatives are both those who share a common ancestor with us or those whom we have got linked through marriage. Relation with relatives is an obligatory act, and the nearest relatives are parents and siblings. Now the question is, how can we sever relations with relatives who are bad-tempered, corrupt, or even faithless? Our divine leaders tell us that we cannot sever relations with these relatives. However, the kind of relation changes according to the conditions. For instance, we can decrease commutations or be in contact with them through telephone, email, or and so on. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Nothing severs the right of relatives. Then, if they are brothers in faith, they have two rights. One is the right of relative and the other is the right of Islam." Relation with relatives has a broad meaning. It includes being kind to them, trying to solve their problems, helping them with their debts, bidding what is good and forbidding what is evil, visiting their patients, respecting them, etc. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Have relation with relatives. Do good to your brothers, even if with good greetings and replying their greetings." Elsewhere, the Imam says, "Have relation with your relatives even with a sip of water." It has been mentioned in Islamic narrations that relation with relatives has many positive impacts. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Relation with relatives makes the temperament good, makes the hand generous, purifies the soul, increases sustenance, and delays the hour of death. It makes the reckoning of the day of judgment easy and prevents man from bad death." On the contrary, the divine leaders have warned against the effects of severing relation with relatives. A man asked the Prophet, "What is the most hated act with God?" The Messenger of Mercy answered, "Associating partner with God." The man asked, "And after that?" The Prophet said, "He who severs relation with relatives." One of the things that create many problems for the digestive system is eating in hurry. Thus, we should avoid eating hurriedly in iftar or sahari, that is pre-dawn meal. We should have the iftar and sahari calmly and slowly. This way, the digestive system will metabolize the food and drink better. We should avoid stress, anxiety, fear, and excitement while eating. The blessed month of Ramadan is a good opportunity to consume healthy oils. Olive oil is the one of the best oils which have been highly recommended by physicians and specialists of nutrition. Sesame oil is also very good. Specialists advise us to consume both animal and plant proteins. Yet, animal protein is absorbed 15% better. However, seeds like lentil, peas, and beans are good if we do not use them extravagantly.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Even when people do not have access to an official to ask him questions, and supervise his work, God is present there. Your work and service is like this. I have frequently said this to various managerial organizations of the country. I said to them that when they work an extra half an hour, no one might notice it. Even your superior may not notice it. And he will not give you a simple thank you. But God sees this. The same is true of unfulfilled obligations and wrong deeds. The statement made by the magnanimous Imam, the whole universe is present in front of God, is very important. May God raise the position of that knowledge-imbued heart. The whole universe is present in front of God. The Arabic word mazhar means a place where someone is present. God is everywhere. Wherever we are, whether we are alone or in a gathering of people, and even in our hearts, imagination, thoughts, and intentions, God the Exalted is present in all these places. The basis of responsibility is this, divine presence. This is the basis of social and political responsibility.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You must know that the decisions that you take, the signature that you sign or refuse to do, the things that you do and do not do are all done in the presence of God. And you were the watcher of what was behind them and the witness to what was hidden from them. Another point that I deem necessary to raise in this very friendly, warm, and good meeting is that even if you and I, who have certain responsibilities in the Islamic Republic, are like this in our personal lives, for instance, if we are not very careful and committed, when we enter the field of responsibility, we must be a lot more careful. For example, if you did not previously attach much significance to night prayers, recommended prayers, keeping a vigil and the like, now that you have become a manager, you must attach significance to them. You must strengthen the things that help you get connected to God. You and I must feel the presence of God when taking or abandoning an action. If this happens, then divine blessings will come pouring.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.